Hello and welcome to the October 16th edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard, the podcast devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and here are the topics that I've got planned for us today. First, get your shower warmed up because we're going to talk about Mitt Romney, or as I've called him recently, Mint Romney. I'll explain why. Is he electable? What does it mean for a candidate to be electable, and why would you care? In evaluating whether Romney is electable, we'll look at the promises that he makes on his campaign website, and you will likely need that shower after you're done hearing about it. Second, two candidates about whom I've spoken favorably on this webcast, they have both joined the unfortunately non-exclusive Candidates Who Shoot Themselves in the Foot Club this week. We'll see what they said and whether we can forgive them in light of how dirty we got wading through Romney's muck. Then, an update on Occupy Wall Street. Yes, they're still there. Are you surprised? I think Rand would not be, and I'll tell you why. Then we're going to talk about the Tea Party. Is the Tea Party just a fading fashion, or are they here to stay, and are they going to have a significant influence on politics for decades to come? It seems the New York Times and much of the GOP hopes that their influence is fading, and I'll ask you what you think, and we'll have some more if there's time. Before we dive in, some logistics for people who are attending live. There's two ways to interact with me. The first, my preference, is the hand raise icon that you see on the dock on the right-hand side of your screen. If you click on it with the green arrow pointing up, that means you'll be raising your hand. When your hand is raised, you'll see a red arrow pointing down. That means if you click on it, you'll be lowering your hand. And then the second way is through the questions box. Some of you have already typed in a couple comments to me. You type in question, comment, etc. into the questions box, and I can also read those on air as well. Okay, so let's dive in. There was a Bloomberg, of course, you know, Bloomberg was where they had the debate this week. A Bloomberg headline, Romney offering management consulting we can believe in, by Michael Kinsley. And I think when he's talking about management consulting, he's talking about the fact that Romney is smug, that one of the dangers is that Romney comes across as too smug. That was discussed in the article. But in effect, Michael Kinsley, the author of this article, is taking for granted that the only two serious contenders right now are Mitt Romney and Rick Perry. And we all know that Perry has really been making a mess of things lately. One of the things that was pretty funny in this article that Kinsley talked about is that Perry didn't seem to get his homework done by the time of the debate this week because he didn't have a plan. And I remember listening to one of Perry's answers, and Perry said, well, you know, you don't really have to have a plan, because he was trying to react to the fact that you've got Herman Cain with his very clear 999 plan, and he talks about the different elements. So Perry says, well, you know, you don't have to have a plan, you just have to, I guess, you know, he meant you have to institute the right kind of policies. But then, of course, he goes on to describe a few of the concrete things that he would do. Isn't that sort of a plan, even if you don't have it very organized, even if you haven't given it any sort of catchy name like 999? Perry's answers have just been a mess. And so then, of course, that makes everyone think that Mitt Romney is the, you know, de facto nominee, that he's just going, we're all just going to pick him. Here in this article, Kinsley, he describes Romney as a pragmatic moderate campaigning as a right-wing zealot. And then he describes Perry as a right-wing zealot governing in some ways as a pragmatic moderate. I guess that could be true, but Perry, with some of the opinions, you know, excuse me, some of the positions that he's talked about and some of the policies that he's instituted in his own state, seems like a, you know, redistribution of wealth, big government, not really conservative, you know. And the two things I'm thinking of course, are the subsidizing of immigrants' education, which he's done, some sort of a Dream Act. And the other, of course, was the much talked about in earlier debates, forced vaccination of, you know, HPV virus on, not vaccinated with the virus, but vaccinated against it for 12-year-old girls. So with those kinds of policies, I wouldn't see that he's a right-wing zealot. It's hard to say what Perry is, and it's especially hard because he can't seem to articulate a position. So here we are with Mitt Romney, and he seems, especially if you look at Perry, right, and you have as your criteria that you would like a president who can stand up and talk for longer than an hour and actually make sense, then Mitt Romney actually looks good. And in fact, a number of people have said that they would support Romney because he's the only one who is electable. So this made me think, well, what is it that people mean by electable? What do you think people mean when they say that Mitt Romney is electable? Any answers, any thoughts at an answer from anyone here? You can go ahead and type an answer quickly if you want. I'm seeing if anyone will raise a hand and tell me what they think they mean, what people think they mean when they say that Mitt Romney is electable. He's pretty and he speaks well, says Alan. Joe says he has good hair. Peter says he will sway independents. Paul says he can beat Obama. And then David says a little bit better than the worst they are used to. David, I'm actually going to challenge you on that one. You'll see if he's better than the worst that they're used to. Or at least maybe he's appearing that way, but when you actually read him on paper, he's different. Robert says they mean he has no principles. He is a pragmatist. Yeah, Pooja says mainstream. Okay, so I think that that's true. So it's that everybody out there likes him. They think that he can actually be elected among independents. Maybe he could also beat supporters of Obama. Of course,
I don't think they like him.
What did you say?
I don't think it's that they like him. I don't think it's that they like him. I don't know who likes him.
So you think people don't like him at all, but they think somebody else likes him?
I guess. Who the hell likes him? I don't know of anyone.
No one actually says I like him, but they all think everybody else will like him.
I guess next guy does.
I mean, I don't know. I don't like fruitcake, right? But I'm going to send it to everybody for Christmas anyway. Right. Is it the same thing? I don't know.
Yeah.
So he's like fruitcake.
He was the most popular.
I just came up with that, actually, but I like this. I like this one. That Mitt Romney is the fruitcake of politics.
That's right.
Nobody likes it, but everybody thinks everybody else wants it.
And everyone gives it to others, so okay, well, someone will like it.
So this is great. So I have a new tweet that's going to just go viral and make me rich and famous now that Mitt Romney is the fruitcake of politics. That's all I'm thinking of right now. If you think about
Robert says that, sorry, Chrissy likes him, but I guess he looks edible to him. I'm sorry.
You are so bad. Or his hair, looks edible to him anyway because it's all coiffed with whatever nice smelling stuff he uses. I don't know. I think the funniest thing, but by the way, on Romney was this week. It was, what's the website that produced that silly video? It was badlipsyncing.com or something. I don't know, but it was funny. So there's all these clips of Romney giving his different speeches, and it is plausible seeming lip reading, of interpretations of what Romney is saying, and it is the funniest stuff. And it was like at the end, it was like fill that ice chest or something, and that's what they left out. It's really funny. It's ridiculous. It's completely random. It could have been made by anybody with any agenda. It's not like they were putting any substance into his mouth. It's just all random and strange and bizarre. But it's very cathartic if you're kind of baffled at the Romney mystique that's been going on around. You've got something, yeah, Bosch?
I've been on a tweet warpath about this the last few days, so if I just read two or three, if you don't mind.
Yeah, you read two or three, and then I'll tell everyone the one that I love the best, which is my mint one. Okay, go ahead.
I said Republicans who think that a candidate who believes in global warming, Islam means peace, and socialized medicine is quote-unquote electable are Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And also this other one about supporting a candidate because you think they'll win is how you end up with a loser, win or lose. And that's the same thing with last time with the McCain.
Right.
And so there was, I went off on all these things, plus I have all those puns, which I could read off after.
Yeah, we have all the great puns. Let's do the puns at the end because we're going to need it. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the substitute for the shower that everyone's going to need. So in terms of electable, there's one of a couple things. One, it could just be this appeal to authority, the fallacy of appeal to authority. And it would be the quantitative version because you're counting on all of these millions of voters that are going to vote for Romney and you're appealing to them, and you say, okay, well, I'm going to support the guy that everybody else supports just because everybody else supports them. And in effect, if you're committing this logical fallacy, you're substituting their judgment as to whether he's good for your own judgment as to whether this is a candidate I should support. But people aren't doing that. And like you said, and like I just coined, you know, he's like the fruitcake of politics. They don't like him, but somehow they think everybody else is going to like him. So let's just, you know, give it to him. I think the reason they think he's electable and the electability is some sort of concern to people is because you want any time or money that you put behind a candidate to actually have some impact against Obama, because Obama is so terrible that it becomes all the more crucial to make sure that whoever we choose is electable, has this
and also,
mysterious
and
quality
also,
of electability.
Would mm-hmm. Democrats be averse to voting for him? Not really. I don't think so. Ultimately,
oh, I mean,
look at him.
Yeah,
he could run as a Democrat with no problem.
Well, he could certainly run as a Democrat. I mean, with the policies that he has, but you know, I don't know whether they would vote for him. I mean, you know, the whole old saying goes, and it's a true saying among objectivists, that if you've got two candidates that
Absolutely.
Are basically putting forth the same policies, the one who is more consistent is going to win. And who's yep. been more consistent than Obama? The only thing I was thinking is that you've got Obama is actually a nihilist, an out-and-out nihilist, whereas in Romney, you've got this kind of pragmatist, power-hungry guy. So there is a difference, but is it one that we're going to be happy? Who knows? So let me go through some of his policies. The one thing I'm going to say about this electability, though, is that I think people are wrong in judging what is electable this time around, because I think they're ignoring the impact of the Tea Party. I think people have dismissed the effect of the Tea Party on what now is electable versus just a few years ago. And we'll talk about that in a later segment in conjunction with that New York Times piece on the Tea Party. So let me tell you, when you go to Romney's Believe in America campaign website, he has a 5-page little executive summary. I don't think he calls it executive summary, but that's, I think, what it would be referred to, of what his 59-point plan consists of. You know, and that was one of the things that he did at the debate this week, is he sort of pummeled everybody. He says, yeah, well, you've got this 999, it's all simple, but you know, in order to fix America, we have to have a complex plan. And so he's got this 59-point plan. The full plan, you can read it if you like, if you really like to take multiple showers, you can go read 160 pages, but he has this nice 5-page summary, and I think you'll agree that we will learn enough just by going through this. Now, on the first page, on the very first page, he talks about 10 different things that he will do on day one if he's president. First, there are 5 bills that he wants to have introduced and then acted upon within the first 30 days. So he'll introduce these 5 bills on day one. And you think, okay, these are going to be amazingly awesome. We're going to get excited. Okay, here we go. First is the American Competitiveness Act. Okay? It will reduce the corporate income tax rate to 25%. Now, is that a big change? Currently, it's 35% as far as I know. And at 35%, it is one of the highest in the world. So I don't think 25% is that bold. But if you call it the American Competitiveness Act, maybe it sounds awesome. Then there's another one called the Open Markets Act. And that would implement various, I guess, pending, floating around trade agreements that already exist out there. One with Colombia, one with Panama, and one with South Korea. Who knows what in the world is in those things? They're already existing out there. He's just glomming onto them and saying, oh, well, they must, you know, increase free trade. And so I'll call it the Open Markets Act and say that I'm in favor of that. So that's the second one. Third one is called the Domestic Energy Act. Now listen to the language. It says it directs the Department of the Interior to undertake a comprehensive survey of American energy reserves in partnership with exploration companies and initiates leasing in all areas currently approved for exploration. So a survey and tries to, I guess, lease areas that are already currently approved. So does that sound very drastic or big or awesome? doing surveys. I mean, government does surveys all day long. I don't know how many billions of dollars we've paid for the government to do surveys. And if it's leasing only in areas that are already currently approved, that doesn't sound like any big deal either. So I'm not excited. Then there is the Retraining Reform Act. And what this does is it consolidates the sprawl of federal retraining programs and returns funding and responsibility for these programs to the states. Now, retraining, by that they mean if you've been fired from a certain line of work where, you know, there's not as many employees needed anymore because there's been innovation, say, and your job has become obsolete and you need to get some training in order to gain some skills so that you are marketable. We've got the federal government, I guess, paying for a lot of this retraining. So his bold move on day one is going to consolidate these, return the funding and responsibility for the programs to the states. So basically, you're giving a blank check to the states to provide retraining. And this is somehow bold and awesome. Then there is the Down Payment on Fiscal Sanity Act. And this is his bold move, okay? You think fiscal sanity, like, you know, now we're going to make maybe some big cut or something? Immediately cuts non-security discretionary spending by 5%. So only non-security and discretionary spending, which means not the entitlement programs, not security spending, by 5%. What does that amount to? It reduces the annual federal budget by $20 billion. Now, to me, $20 billion, if you gave it to me, that would be a huge amount of money. But we have learned, and I have painfully learned during the time that I've been doing this podcast, this is my 33rd podcast, by the way, I have learned the actual magnitude of the federal budget. It was hard for me at first. I was always confusing billions and trillions. But now we know that the deficit is $1.7 trillion. $20 billion is nothing at all. But we're supposed to be impressed that on day one, he's going to, you know, put something out there that's going to cut $20 billion. This is all symbolic at best. It's timid. It's crazy. So that's just the five bills. So let's look at the five executive orders for day one. Maybe there's something exciting and awesome there. One is an order to pave the way to end Obamacare. In order to pave the way to end Obamacare. Now, why didn't he put under his five bills for day one an introduction of a bill to repeal Obamacare? If he had put that under one of his five bills for day one, I think I would have been slightly impressed. And maybe I would have come out for Romney, especially when we talk later about what Johnson and Kaine did to themselves this week. But no. Instead, under the executive order side of this nice, pretty little page on his website, it says he's got an order to pave the way to end Obamacare. So what does that exactly mean? It says it's going to direct the Secretary of Health and Human Services and all relevant federal officials to do what? It says return the maximum possible authority to the states to innovate and design healthcare solutions that work best for them. Does that sound like anything like repealing Obamacare at all? It doesn't sound like repealing it. And it says return the maximum possible authority. Well, what does that mean? It's bizarre. Now, he talks about it as waivers, you know, as Obamacare waivers. But some people have said, and
he
I think clearly, rightly,
no, he safely never says repeal.
No.
I'm sorry, well, he never used the word repeal.
Now, later in this huge, I mean, this is, you know, a five-page document summarizing his main point.
He actually uses the term?
He does actually use the word repeal, but it's very clever the way he uses it. So let me get there and you'll see.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I mean, you didn't want to read through this. Like some people had said, you know, Amy, we're so glad you took the hit and read this junk, but it is pretty gross. So that was one. The second one, in order to cut red tape. Elimination of Obama-era regulations that unduly burden the economy or job creation. And then it's going to cap annual increases in regulatory costs at $0. Okay, so basically he's saying only Obama-era regulations are ones that we need to target and worry about, and the only ones we're going to get rid of those are the ones that, quote, unduly burden the economy. Who gets to decide what unduly burdens the economy or not? And then this idea of, you know, capping annual increases in regulatory costs at zero, so somebody's going to analyze how much it costs to conform to regulations, you know, to comply with them, and I mean, who knows if the analysis is ever accurate, and why would we accept the current status quo as to regulatory costs anyway? That is not exciting at all. True, regulations, compliance with regulations is probably costing more each year, and so that if you don't make it cost more, that's something, but it's not radical in any way. Then, the next one, I love the wording of this one, an order to boost domestic energy production, an order. So it's an executive order, mind you, right? But he thinks he's going to boost it. Now, how is he going to boost it? He's going to direct the Department of Interior to implement a process for rapid issuance of drilling permits to developers with established safety records seeking to use pre-approved techniques in pre-approved areas. So given all the status quo, he's just going to make sure that the permit process is more rapid. It's not like they're changing anything substantive. It's just the procedure of getting that permit that he would change. Now, my big question is, the only way you can boost domestic energy production simply by having a rapid issuance of these permits, I think I did hear that Obama has, for no good reason, held up the giving out of these permits. That, you know, he doesn't have a substantive reason, that he's done it through sorts of, you know, procedural hangups. So that's fine, okay, you're not going to have those procedural hangups. But my question is, why would, given everything that we've heard about this so far, you know, all these bold plans of Romney, why would people just jump in and invest just because Romney was elected? From what I hear so far in here, it's not like if I was an investor, I'd say, okay, yeah, I'm going to go, you know, drill, open up a whole new oil rig and everything else. I don't know. Another executive order. Sanction China for unfair trade practices. And this, to me, came out of the blue. Romney talked about it during the debate this week. He just seemed to suddenly go on a bent on China. And what is it that he actually means to do here? He says, I'm going to, and this was during the debate, he says, I will label China as it is a currency manipulator. And I will go after them for stealing our intellectual property, and they will recognize that if they cheat, there is a price to pay. I certainly don't want a trade war, but we can't have a trade surrender either. End quote. So that's what he said during the debate. Here on his website, he says he's going to direct the Department of the Treasury to list China as a currency manipulator in its biannual report, and it's going to direct the Department of Commerce to assess countervailing duties on Chinese imports if China does not quickly move to float its currency. Okay, so I guess the idea is that China is artificially propping up the price of its currency, and he thinks, and it's probably true, although, you know, this whole idea that you've got currency that isn't based on any sort of gold standard, it's, you're just kind of out there in rationalist land trying to figure this out because it has no relation to reality. The prices don't have any real relation to anything, it seems. But I gather that if you float your currency, you're allowing the price of it to vary with actual demand that's out there on the market, as complex as that demand calculation might be, but you're letting it out there and float. They don't do that. And so what are we going to do? We're going to make Chinese imports more expensive. And that's going to fix everything. Now, as far as I know, from my training in economics, I actually did take some economics classes, quite a few, in college. I got a math applied science degree, and I had physics and economics as my applied sciences. One thing I always took away from it is that even if the other country has various barriers to trade and tariffs and stuff, it is still better for you to remove any of those barriers, keep as few as possible, have no barriers actually, and let those goods be cheap to us. Why? Because then we can buy those cheap things and then we can spend the money, for instance, on investing in new technology that we can use to compete, right? If we have to instead put these duties on their imports and then therefore make them more expensive, it's a waste of consumer funds, it makes us less well off. So, you know, this whole idea of the trade balance being the big thing, it's a bunch of garbage, and anybody who's been trained in economics knows it. So that doesn't sound that great at all. And I don't know why to single out China in particular. Maybe it's because we owe so much money to China, so he wants to try to get leverage. That's the only thing I can think of. Then the fifth one is, in order to empower American businesses and workers, it's going to reverse the executive orders issued by Obama that tilt the playing field in favor of organized labor, including the one that encourages the use of union labor on major government construction projects. So that one executive order seems to me totally, completely good. Right. If Obama actually, you know, issued an executive order that tilted the playing field, so to speak, in the favor of organized labor, and you're going to go ahead and reverse that, that sounds good to me. That sounds, you know, unequivocally just good. I have no problems with it that I can see. The only thing is that it's not a huge deal. And to say, okay, this is one of the big five things I'm going to do on day one. So he's got this list of 10 things he's going to do on day one. My question for you is, is everyone impressed? Are you now going to vote for Mitt Romney because you want all of these 10 things to be done on day one? You're excited, you're sold, that's it? Anyone? Let's see if I got any hands raised. Oh, I've got...
Quit Romney.
I've got Deborah here. Deborah, are you ready to vote for him?
No. This is just pathetic. And this is why I say that Romney is the least electable of the Republican frontrunners. He stands for nothing. I mean, this is just ridiculous. All his supposed bold economic recovery measures, it's just nothing. It's not going to do anything.
I mean, was there anything in there that excited you at all? I mean, I think I'm right not to be very excited about a cut of the corporate income tax rate to 25%. That doesn't mean hardly anything, right?
No, particularly when they're still being regulated to death. I mean, you could cut their corporate rate to zero, but if they're not allowed to do anything, then what difference does it make?
Right.
And the union executive order, that's the only one that's semi-good, because there's a lot of government sort of controls that tilt government contracts and stuff, that you can't get them unless your company's unionized and that kind of thing. And that's really ridiculous. So that's good, I guess. But I don't see, you know, I don't think that Romney is really unique in that way. I think that probably most of the Republican candidates would do stuff like that. So I don't think that it necessarily distinguishes him. I mean, he's just... there's nothing about him that excites me at all. And then this Romney Care, I mean, it came out last week that that Romney's advisors have been consulted by Obama and Obama's advisors,
right,
and in order to structure Obamacare, and that the Massachusetts having passed it, it kind of made it easier for Obama to design his health care bill in the same way and to pass it. So, the reason I think that people say that he's electable, mm-hmm, I've heard sort of political strategist types say that it has to do with the fact that he has raised more money than the other candidates and that he has a national organization already in place. So it's just for that purely pragmatic reason that they think that he has an advantage over the other candidates.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of that when we also talk about the New York Times article, because some of the ways that current candidate funding or campaign funding is being done are discussed in there as well. So right now I'm going to go on with this, Deborah, and you may still need a shower. Right now, do you need a shower? It's not too bad. It's not like worse than you expected?
No, it isn't worse than I expected. I already have a very low opinion of Romney, so you didn't really surprise me.
I didn't surprise you too badly. Okay, I'm gonna go on
with
this.
How about the puns?
No, I first have to continue to shock you further, because it's
okay.
Yeah, it's still,
because the puns will be the shower.
The puns will be the shower. That's right. That's what we'll do. We'll shower everybody with our wonderful puns. So then we go to his various headings that he has. So that was just day one. Day one, he's going to do all those bold, awesome things, and you're just going to be so excited, right? You're going to be so happy that you voted for Romney, if you did, because all those things will be done on day one. So then he talks about other points of his 59-point plan, and these are just talked about in a general way, so I don't have numbers. You know, there's different headings that he's got under this five-page summary. So then first is tax policy. And he says that Romney wants to make sure taxation becomes an instrument for promoting economic growth. Okay, now listen to that language. And to me, this is the same sort of language from Romney who says, and he said this in the debate the other night about, you know, to whom he's going to give the tax cuts. He says, if I'm going to spend precious tax dollars giving a tax cut, and then he goes on, you know, to say that he's got to give it to the people who have been hurt the most, or, you know, and he even went so far to say, as I'm not worried about rich people. But this type of language where he says, if I'm going to spend precious tax dollars. He has completely internalized that Washington mindset about it's his dollars to spend. You know, whose money is this exactly? You know, why does he get to spend it? He doesn't have any sense of, you know, if he is going to get some tax money, it's a trust of the American people. I don't think he internalizes that as well. But it says he's going to hold the line on individual income tax rates. Hold the line. He doesn't say he's going to reduce them. And he says he's going to eliminate taxes on interest, dividends, and capital gains for low and middle income taxpayers. So the elimination of taxes on interest, dividends, and capital gains is only going to go to low and middle income taxpayers, which means it's not going to have as much effect. Why? Because low and middle income taxpayers don't save as much. They don't invest as much. So how much effect will that actually have on job creation? No, this is just more class warfare junk. Then it says he's going to pursue a conservative overhaul that applies lower and flatter rates to a broader tax base. Doesn't tell you what the rates are here, but I think there is some detail in the rates, and that's what they were pursuing with him in the debate. And they were questioning him because, in effect, he was going to penalize, relatively speaking, people at a lower income level than even Obama was. That was one of the things they called him on in the, you know, in the debate. His cutoff was 200,000 and Obama's was 250,000 or something. Then he's talking about some sort of territorial system for corporate taxes, and that this is going to encourage multinational corporations to bring profits back into the United States. I don't understand taxes to that extent to see what difference a territorial system would make, but you know, he's trying to encourage it through tax policy. Now, in terms of regulatory policy, again, he cites only regulations that were passed during the Obama administration. It says, Mitt Romney will act to swiftly tear down the vast edifice of regulations the Obama administration has imposed on the economy. Now, Obama is just the last in a long line. And as, you know, I saw that one clip of Harry Binswanger from the upcoming Atlas Shrugged documentary. I actually think it's out in movie theaters, maybe a little bit, and it's certainly available on a DVD, that Ayn Rand and the Prophecy of Atlas Shrugged. And apparently there were 80,000 new regulations under the Bush administration, and you know, Harry Binswanger's going crazy about that. There's plenty of regulations that were passed under earlier presidents that also need to be addressed. But here is Romney just saying, you know, the vast edifice of regulations under the Obama administration. Boy, that's just terrible. And we're so glad he's going to go after those, right? Says he will also seek to make structural changes to the federal bureaucracy and ensure that economic growth remains front and center. And it's this is where he talks about the repealing. He says, Romney will work to repeal laws like Obamacare and Dodd-Frank that have given bureaucrats unprecedented discretion to craft unpredictable job-killing regulations. So laws like those, how about just actually promising to repeal those, Obamacare and Dodd-Frank? That would be nice. But all he says is that he'll work to repeal laws like those. He'll also initiate an immediate review of all Obama-era regulations. Okay, first of all, it's just a review. And then it's only Obama-era regulations. Why? Because they want to eliminate any that unduly burden the economy, etc. And then he says he's also going to adopt a new cost-conscious approach to environmental regulation. So just a little reminder, he is an environmentalist. He is happy to continue to regulate on behalf of the environment and against you and your life. Trade policy. It says Romney's going to work to open foreign markets for American goods and services on terms that work for America. Lord knows what that means. It could be that he's going to manipulate trade policies so that him and his buddies can get rich while he's in office. Everybody knows, like I said earlier, with regard to foreign markets, if we just tear down our barriers, we will be so much the richer because we'll be able to get goods more cheaply that our economy will take off that much more. But no, if you're a big government type, you just want to control, 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 tweak this, tweak that. And, you know, you might tweak it according to some policy that we're all going to clap for because we're all trained to clap for the tweaking in favor of a better policy. But it's all the same garbage. Says he will seek a trade promotion authority to pursue new trade relationships. Trade Promotion Authority, I don't know what that means. Is it a brand new agency, a new alphabet agency, or maybe it's one that already exists and I should know about it and it's a part of a vast bureaucracy that I don't understand? Doesn't sound that great. And then it says he's going to open a Reagan Economic Zone, which is a multilateral trade bloc open to any country committed to the principles of open markets and free enterprise. Now, I don't think United States right now could qualify as a country that is committed to the principles of open markets and free enterprise based on the conduct of our government, and yet we're going to tell other countries what to do with respect to these principles. It's a bunch of garbage. Then it says Romney will take unilateral action and also partner with other nations that are affected by China's refusal to participate responsibly in the global economy. So we're going to somehow increase the price of goods made in China and try to punish China thereby. You know, my attitude on trading with China is either you decide it's a rights-violating, potentially dangerous-to-us nation that you are on principle not going to trade with, or if you're going to trade with them, just have free trade so that you can have the most benefit from engaging in that free trade. Do one or the other, but don't have this idea of, oh, well, let's have it fair and, you know, I'll tariff this and you tariff that. It just this tinkling stuff. So next heading, energy policy. Regulatory reform, support for increased production. Lord knows what he means by support for increased production. And then he says, government that focuses on funding basic research instead of chasing fads and picking winners. So he's still talking about government funding of research on energy, which is more big government garbage. It says he will streamline federal regulation of energy exploration, and he wants the government to act as a facilitator of energy exploration. Again, how can government facilitate? The best thing it can do is just get out of the way. But no, you know, they can't completely get out of the way because they have to protect all of us, is what he thinks. You know, it's this very, very paternalistic conception of government to protect us, but within that context of, you know, they're going to regulate so that they can protect us, they will facilitate, whatever that means. And then he says he will significantly expand the areas available for energy development, including, and this is actually good stuff, he says the Gulf of Mexico, the Outer Continental Shelf, Western Lands, and Alaska. So if that's true, significantly expand. Now, why not just open it up completely? That would be the true free market approach, is just government has no say. Private property owners can figure out whether they want to engage in energy development of these areas of land and just leave it to private interests. But no, you can't exactly do that. And then it says he's going to encourage, which of course means your tax dollars, encourage continued development of unconventional reserves like shale gas and oil that hold enormous promise for expanding the base of U.S. reserves. So that means somebody's going to get rich off of those technologies, even though it's probably too soon for them to be profitable. One thing it says that he wants to do, he says he wants to strengthen partnerships with Canada and Mexico to expand opportunities for American companies in the development of their nation's resources. And when I think of, you know, investing in Mexico to develop energy resources, my mind goes to the San Sebastian line in Atlas Shrugged. Lord knows how that might work out. So that all sounds beautiful, too. Labor policy, he wants to protect the worker rights. I don't know what he thinks those are, and employer flexibility that's crucial to innovation, economic growth, and job creation. So he wants to have an even-handed approach, as he calls it, an even-handed approach to labor relations. I pretty much gag there. The one thing that he said that's good under the labor policy section is he said he has to put an end to the undemocratic practice of allowing unions to deduct money directly from worker paychecks and spend it on political causes with which the workers may disagree. Now, That's a very principled, good thing to do, but I bet you any money he's doing it just because he wants to stay in power and be reelected, and he knows that unions won't like him with his other stuff. So that's nice. Then there's another section called human capital policy. And human capital is a term that I heard in economics classes, and particularly macroeconomics classes, where you're talking about the economy at large. And I hate that term because it's just like there's all this human capital and then the government decides how to manipulate it or something, as if, you know, again, it's the government's to do something. One thing he wants to do is retrain American workers to ensure that they have the education and skills to match the jobs of today's economy. That is a money pit if I've ever heard one. Why should the federal government be paying for retraining? So then he says what he wants to do is he wants to have a partnership. First of all, he's going to send this retraining to the states. We already heard that in the, you know, first day's agenda. So he's going to give these grants to the states, and then he wants to focus the retraining efforts on a partnership that brings together the states and the private sector. Now I'm thinking of Solyndra and the enormous money pit that Solyndra was, but just imagine it's going to happen on a smaller scale all over the country in the name of retraining American workers and making them better. So this block grant is going to give major funding streams to the states, your tax dollars, and who knows what they're actually going to accomplish. And then it says he's going to raise the ceiling on the number of visas issued to holders of advanced degrees in math, science, and engineering who have job offers in those fields from U.S. companies. That sounds okay. I mean, as far as it goes, it's okay. Of course, it's picking winners and losers, which he said in another section he didn't want to do. But, you know, the more good people and productive people that you want to bring to the United States, you know, the better, as far as I'm concerned. It says Romney will also work to establish a policy that staples a green card to the diploma of every eligible student visa holder who graduates from an American university with an advanced degree in math, science, or engineering. So I was thinking, well, why math, science, or engineering? Now, of course, they think it's technology. I was thinking maybe he doesn't want to give any good philosophers citizenship or green cards here because any good philosopher is going to call him on the inconsistency and horrible anti-life qualities of his policies. So, you know, you wouldn't want any good philosophers here. We just want those people in the math, science, and engineering who don't think about these things. But then I started to think about this. You know, we talked about Steve Jobs last week, and I'm still getting upset, you know, when I see articles about him, and I'm looking forward to reading the forthcoming biography on him. Steve Jobs did not have a degree in math, science, or engineering, right? And what if we didn't have him? So, I mean, why give this priority to these people and say, well, you've got to have the degree and that's going to make you the productive person? Steve Jobs, who is arguably the most innovative, productive person that we've had in the United States for last several decades, no degree at all. Certainly not in math, science, or engineering. They said he was not very good technically. Isn't that right, Bosch? He wasn't very good technologically speaking. Are you there?
That's right. Oh, I think Wozniak was the guy for that.
Yeah, he was the tech implementation guy.
All right.
So now then finally, we say that fiscal policy is our next focus. And it says that Romney will immediately move to cut spending and cap it at 20% of GDP. Now, as far as I know, that still is pretty high, and it's not that impressive to me. And they reiterate here that Romney's going to move immediately to cut non-security discretionary spending by 5%, so a whole $20 billion. Then there's reforming Medicaid. He wants to have Medicaid be a federal block grant that's administered by the states again. And it says he will provide the leadership necessary to make progress in reforming other entitlement programs, which is a total empty promise going nowhere at all. Then it says he will pursue a balanced budget amendment to ensure that out-of-control borrowing and spending is of the Obama administration is never repeated. So see how he keeps invoking the Obama administration in here? You know, he thinks that people want to hear the Obama administration, so he'll repeat that there.
Can I just say something between it?
Sure.
I'm sorry, about the electability thing.
Yeah.
Now, the old thinking is this, in their mind, at least Washington politicians, they respect people who win. In their mind, well, the last guy who won, you know, he's most like Romney, so, you know, that's why he's quote-unquote electable. In their mind, I mean, well, he won. Look, and that's why Romney keeps bringing up these, keeps invoking Obama as well.
Right.
He's the president. He won. I mean, you got to give him that. That, you know, that type of respect from a hack politician, power-hungry politician.
See, yeah, I think it's as simple as, oh, well, everybody hates Obama now. He's getting the worst ratings, you know, in every single poll that's done, that was ever done.
Yeah, let's get a guy who people hate less.
Yeah.
People don't really like.
And basically, he's running against Obama, and if he just keeps, you know, and, it, you know, there was a heading on this that I didn't read to you guys, but it says, you know, the book released by the campaign underscores President Obama's failed approach to each policy area crucial to turning around the economy. So they're all just reacting to Obama and saying, well, how can I tweak this and tweak that a little bit and still remain the pragmatic big government guy and get the vote from the anti-Obama sentiment that's out there. So it says Romney's going to rebuild the foundations of the American economy on the principles of free enterprise, hard work, and innovation. First of all, hard work and innovation aren't really principles. They're just entities, they're concepts, you know, to describe what people do. There is a principle of free enterprise, but he wouldn't know it if it hit him. And, you know, this is what I think makes him dangerous, because he's saying that everything that we've just talked about, and I've told you the essence, you know, of this summary of his plan here, that this represents the principles of free enterprise being put into practice. This is what makes him dangerous. And it was funny, because I'll talk a little bit later about, I watched Peter Schiff's latest vlog, as they call it, his little video, and he was saying, you know, it's very dangerous because America is the supposed representative of capitalism, and we don't have anything like it, and there's all these horrible things that are going on that aren't the responsibility of capitalism. You know, if this plan is supposed to be what free enterprise means, I mean, it's crazy. You know, if he says, well, we're bringing in a little bit of the principle of free enterprise, but we're, you know, not going to be too extreme about it. We're balancing it with the needs to, you know, protect society or whatever he wants to do to talk about his balancing thing. Because that's what he's doing. He's not applying the principle of free enterprise. He might be saying, well, let's, you know, let's add a little free enterprise in with our socialism. It's great. So he says his plan emphasizes, now this is what he's saying, rather than short-term fixes, right? Short-term fixes are the bad thing. His plan emphasizes something way better. You want to hear how he phrases it? Critical structural adjustments. Yeah. Better than short-term fixes, right? So he says his plan seeks to reduce taxes, spending, blah, blah, blah. And then he says in the next paragraph, the plan does not increase the size of the federal budget or bureaucracy. It does not increase it. That is so bold, right? I'm just laughing because I'm like, you know, this is like his conclusion of his great plan. It does not increase the size of the federal budget. And this is, it does not promise the immediate creation of some imaginary number of jobs, he says, because government cannot create jobs. Well, of course, that's true. And I'm glad he conceded that, right? But there's no way that anyone's going to create jobs when he's just tweaking at the margins and nobody can trust that there's going to be any significant curb on the size and scope of government, you know, any significant rolling back.
No, he sounds like a busy guy. I mean, he wants to get all this. I mean, he's on board. I mean, he's so adamant. It seems like he's, in his own mind, he will be the inevitable next president.
Well,
to the point where he wakes up in the morning and probably says, good morning, Mr. President, in a mirror. Maybe tells his family to call him Mr. President.
I mean, who knows what sort of crazy things he's telling himself when he looks himself in the mirror.
Whenever it's challenged, he giggles, and then he goes into a ready-made answer.
Yeah.
So ugly.
Yeah. In that article from Bloomberg, the guy was saying that one of the big dangers is that he's going to come across as smug, because in the business world, I guess they're told that they need to come across as smug so that they can attract everybody to go for the deal that he's proposing or whatever. And so that somehow this is his modus operandi that he's internalized through being this shady business guy, or not even shady, but just kind of successful, high-profile business guy. I don't know if he's had shady business dealings. lines. But
he's a shitty politician.
A lot of the stuff that he's talking about in here, though, seems to me to be an invitation for certain people to take advantage of, you know, the latest so-called free trade agreement or whatever it is that they pass. So there's going to be plenty of opportunities for him and his friends to get rich if he does all these different things. But then he says, this is the pandering last paragraph of his little statement here. He says, any American living, you said, thank you, it's the last one. Yeah. I've cut significantly. I'm just giving you a few highlights here and there.
These are his 59, and someone mocked me all day. 59.
Yeah. Oh my God. It was
so kidding me?
It's like,
you know what? He knows no one will read it. And so he's like, you know.
Well, and I've read the, I've taken enough out of this 5 pages, and I think anybody who's listening to me is taken enough from my summary of the 5 pages to know what this guy's about, right? Yep. So he says,
you can get away with more if you don't have people read it. But anyway, sorry.
So here's his dramatic closing. He says, any American living through this economic crisis will immediately recognize the severity of the break that Mitt Romney proposes from our current course. Is that a severe break from our current course? That I've read to you so far?
Is he speaking in third person? You know?
And then it's that argument from intimidation. Well, any American, certainly you'll recognize that this is a severe break.
Because and if you don't.
That's right. If you don't, you're crazy. So it goes on. It's ridiculous. He says, he is calling for a fundamental change in Washington's view of how economic growth and prosperity are achieved, how jobs are created, and how government can support these endeavors. So again, he's always talking about government being in a supportive role. Right. Government can only impede. Government can't produce. Government is a gun. At the most simple level, government is using force against people to protect people from certain bad things, right? So all it has is a gun. How can it support? All it can do is get out of the way. And he is not internalize this message, even with the Tea Party. He's just done. So then he says, his program, he says, it is at once a deeply conservative return to policies that have served our nation well and a highly ambitious departure from the policies of our current leadership. It's deeply conservative and highly ambitious.
It's so deeply that it'll never rise to the surface.
He says,
so deep.
He says, in short, it is a plan to get America back to work.
Man.
So that's our guy. That is the guy, the default nominee that we might have to hold our nose and vote for. I'm just telling you, Bosch, I mean, particularly with what we get to talk about, you know, at the beginning of the next hour with these other guys shooting themselves in the foot this week, we might have to vote for this guy. So this guy's got to go down. Is everybody ready for the shower that we need? We all need a shower. Yeah, I think
we
need some puns. So what are yours?
This was some friends. Excuse me, I don't want to name them, but Mitt Romney.
Yes,
a friend said, admit Romney's not the guy. Matt Romney, because he'll let Democrats walk all over him. And then you thought of these, Mutt Romney.
I like Mutt Romney.
Truly bipartisan politician.
Yeah, because he's the mixed breed politician, Mutt Romney. Uh-huh.
Mitt Romney, you thought of that as well?
Yes, Mitt Romney, because he plans to rob all of us.
Right.
Yeah.
Robert says, wrong me. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
And then I thought, you know, this old one, Mitt Romney, because he says jihad has nothing to do with Islam. And unfit Romney. Sounds like Mitt starts with shh, Romney.
Yeah.
Mitiocrity. Quit Romney. And last one, moot Romney, please.
Yeah, that would be the best if he was moot. Now, one of the ones that I liked was Mint Romney. And the reason I liked Mint Romney is because I think of him as those horrible phony tasting breath mints, you know? And basically his coiffed hair and his slick demeanor is being used as a cover to sort of mask the horrible stench of the stale socialist and pragmatist policies that he's trying to push over on us. So I like Mitt Romney, but now I think Mitt Romney is the fruitcake of politicians. It's even better than that because it's like we think other people want him or something, and nobody really wants it for themselves.
No.
They just want to like get him elected
Even his supporters can't support him. They can't. They say, "Who else?" That's our argument. Who else? There are others.
Yeah. No, but I think he is. He's the He's the fruitcake of politicians, and I am not looking forward to a prospect of voting for him. Big question for people, if it's just Romney versus Obama, now hearing what I've told you today, do you vote for Romney?
I truly can't say. I truly, truly can't say personally. I truly can't.
So you don't know who you're going to vote for?
I don't know. I don't. No. No, I mean, look, I can never vote for Obama. I can't do that ever. I will vote against him, but I don't know if I can vote against him with this guy.
So
I mean that.
All you guys who are on the podcast now, go ahead and type and say, John says, I like fruitcake, but not Mitt. Lucas says, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, luckily we don't have that choice in front of us today.
In the moment
we don't
of truth,
know who to vote for.
You know, I don't know.
Craig says, with your feet. Now, what does vote with your feet mean? Am I thick, Bosch? Is there something I should get from that? Vote with your feet?
I don't know. Keep walking. Get the hell out. Don't vote.
David says, I consider voting for Obama instead of Romney in order to make things worse so we can hit rock bottom so we can wake up sooner. Yeah, I am concerned that we wouldn't survive another Obama presidency. Craig says, leave the country.
That's what walk with your feet. That's what vote with your feet means.
Okay, that's what it means. Thank you. And then Mark says, yeah, I wouldn't vote for Obama or Romney. Michael says, I'd be tempted to go with the out-and-out socialist Obama.
People have thought that, but could we survive? I highly doubt it. Because everything will be entrenched. I mean, Obamacare will be here, and it'll be over. And I don't know. We have to survive in the meantime.
Robert says, stay home. Yeah, and that's what I did last time. I could not vote for McCain. I just could not. Now, of course, McCain's making himself look all attractive now. He's kind of moving and shaking in the Senate. But, you know, even the Senate, you've got McCain and Rand Paul, and they're out there with the new jobs bill that the Senate Republicans have just proposed. Of course, it won't be passed, but they're proposing it. They're trying to show that they're trying to do something. But they even speak that language of this bill will, create X number of jobs or whatever.
Like,
government doesn't create jobs. Government gets out of the way.
I wish he'd say that. Just, let's get the hell out of the way. Just say it.
Yeah. Now, Robert says, wouldn't vote for him, but in New York, he'd lose the state anyway, so it wouldn't matter that much. And I think that's true. There's a lot of states in which your vote doesn't really matter. Froda says, vote with our feet, as in move to Singapore. Hmm. Vote no to both, says Joe. Let's see. A spoiled ballot, if possible. So actually put no on both. Actually, that might be satisfying, right? If you decided you could not vote for either candidate, could go there and register your protest by putting a no vote on both.
Hell in front.
Yeah, that's right. But write hell in, and that would really disqualify your ballot. But who knows? The computer might be programmed now that you actually can't vote no to both of them, or you have to choose just one as a yes. It might not even let you protest that way anymore. So that might be, in and of itself, an argument for a return to the paper ballots.
Chris has something good and true. Obama takes us off the cliff at 100 miles per hour, Romney at 90 miles per hour. How is this a choice? Absolutely right.
Right. Now, one thing I was going to ask Chris and others who are on, are you surprised at how horrible this plan of his is? At how just bereft of any
It did
content.
Nothing for him. It does nothing for him.
I go back to the homework analogy that this author of the Bloomberg article, let me get his name again, Michael Kinsley, he was saying that, there's this turning your homework in on time, and he says that Perry didn't even finish his homework on time because he goes to the debate without a plan. Now, Romney's got his plan, but if you look at his plan, right, I think of his plan as the student who turns in his report with that real fancy cover on it, and he pads his report with all sorts of impressive sounding things that amount to nothing, and they often use the thesaurus a lot to come up with all those very $5-$10 word synonyms,
and that will hopefully appeal to all, hopefully.
Yeah, and moreover, sometimes a student will add those things that he thinks the teacher wants to hear in hopes that it's going to give him a higher grade. So hear all those mentions of the evil Obama administration.
He's such a slick rat.
He's totally contemptuous for his audience, because it's like we can't remember a time before Obama that only the Obama regulations are the ones, you know. So he wants to do all these things, you know, have the fancy cover, pad it with the impressive sounding language and everything, add the stuff that you want to hear, but he doesn't want it to look too obvious. And so you're supposed to believe that this is his sincere plan to implement free enterprise principles for our country. Awesome, right? What do you think?
Greatness,
yeah. Robert says support ARI instead of voting, and I think that is a good plan. Rob says, is the Republican candidate for president as important as electing a Republican majority in the Senate? Now, that is another way to go, and I actually saw, Dr. Hurd today came out for voting for Obama and gridlock. So trying to get Republican majorities. The only thing that makes me nervous about that, in a normal political situation in which your president didn't bend the rules all over the place.
And didn't hate the country.
Yeah, and didn't hate, and wasn't a total nihilist, right? Then I would think that would be a good one.
It's true. It's not business as usual. This guy is a destructive force.
Yeah, we used to say, okay, let's vote for gridlock, but in speeches that I haven't watched an Obama speech for a few weeks. So I'm going to have to do my duty and go back and do that again. But he has talked explicitly about things he will do via executive order or regulatory agency rule tinkering or however it is that he gets certain things done. He's trying to do the maximum he can. There was one example you gave me this week. I forget what it was, Bosch, about he was going to try to do something without Congress standing in the way, or that he always resented Congress getting in the way of the things that he wants to do. It's like, I can't believe that there's certain rules that I have to follow.
Yeah, he looked really bugged. Yeah. Like, oh, man.
So that's the thing that concerns me about letting him have any power for any more time than that he does not
stop the hour.
He doesn't stick by the rules. Yeah, I know. I'm out of time. So we've got Michael saying, I can hear one of the computers quoting Ghostbusters, choose the form of the destructor, Obama or Romney. It's been a long time since I heard Ghostbusters, but I have a vague memory of that. GOP field is pathetic, says Robert. Deborah says, not surprised. This is the man who's passed socialized medicine in his state. Why would anyone have expected anything different?
It should have been the end of him.
He seems to sort of talk a good game sometimes, though. But, I mean, these are things that we should have known from some of the comments that he's made in the past. So, for instance, there was the one debate where he said it's at the heart of the party to help those in need. You know, that's one of the things that the GOP stands for. And then, you know, those other comments about, you know, he's spending the money, the fact that he has stood his ground with regard to Social Security. He believes that we must preserve Social Security as essentially the type of program that it is. You know, this idea of phasing it out doesn't even enter into his consciousness. So I'm hoping that I have firmly and totally obliterated Romney as any kind of a good or attractive candidate in your mind. And if I've done that, then I guess we're going to call it the top of the hour, right? Yep. Yeah, Bosch, we have to go on to something else.